is the Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
Today you'll hear from the new Bureau of Meteorology CEO when he fronted Senate estimates this week. And guess what? You have permission to ask questions about the new website.
I think it's reasonable for the Australian public to ask us what's going on.
How many charges were laid after finding the misuse of environmental water monitoring in New South Wales by a government department?
In answer to the question that I asked, what penalties were applied?
No penalties were applied.
No penalties were applied. Because no laws were broken.
Thank you.
More on that soon, and we'll talk the season and farming conditions today in the High Country.
We're certainly not out of the woods in terms of a dry, hot summer, so we won't be looking to make massive changes, and unfortunately we've probably destocked a bit early on some classes of stock, but we can always sit on feed for the autumn, which is less reliable up here than a spring, so long grass in the paddock is better than no grass.
We loved seeing you yesterday, but it's also good to be back in the studio talking about the issues that matter to you.
The Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
The Bureau of Meteorology has again defended spending nearly $100 million on its controversial new website. New CEO Stuart Minchin, Environment Minister Murray Watt and Bureau of Meteorology staff were grilled about the overhauled site at a Senate hearing. Watching on was Justine Longmore.
New BOM CEO Stuart Minchin has only been in the top job for 3 weeks, but it was mainly left to him to answer questions about the agency's new website and IT upgrade at Senate Estimates. The hearing was running 5 hours behind schedule, so the BOM wasn't up until 20 past 10. That gave senators only 40 minutes to grill the Bureau before the hearing concluded. Most of the questions focused on the cost of the website and the major IT upgrade called Robust that it was a part of. Dr. Minchin.
The Bureau's website has been key focus of late, and I want to put some context around that project on the record. In 2015, the Bureau experienced a significant cyber intrusion, followed by major technology outages in 2016. The Bureau needed to completely transform its vast information and observing technology systems. The Robust program was created in response to this.
Dr. Minchin said the Robust program cost $866 million until June 2024, and a transition program to complete unfinished projects cost an additional $47 million. As he revealed last week, the website cost was 10% of that program.
The new website accounted for approximately $96 million of the overall cost of the Robust program. This cost reflects a significant investment required to fully rebuild all the layers of technology and system that underpins the website. We needed to make sure it is secure and stable and can draw in the huge amounts of data gathered from our observing network and weather models as we handle millions of visits each day.
He acknowledged the website didn't meet the expectations of the Australian public.
The response to the launch of the new BOM website shows that we didn't get it right for some sectors of the community. We accept this feedback, and I have personally seen firsthand just how committed the Bureau staff are to understanding and addressing this feedback.
Victorian Liberal Senator Sarah Henderson asked how $96 million could be spent on a website that she's described as a dog's breakfast.
It's very simple to say it's a website. The website is what people see, but underpinning that is a whole technology stack that goes from 10,000 instruments in the field that are feeding that data through into ultimately one of our supercomputers. It's being fed through multiple models. It then gets spat out into operational systems. Our meteorologists pull those models together and create the forecasting itself that then makes it into the website.
The Robust program has been examined during previous Senate hearings, and South Australian Greens Senator Barbara Pocock didn't hold back last night.
Really, more broadly, I feel this project has been a really, you know, nightmare Harvard case study in contract failure and management of contracts, failure of leadership, and completely unacceptable and unethical behaviour by the very big consultants who have been at the trough.
Dr. Minchin said the program has been reviewed several times.
The program, the Robust program as a whole, though, has undergone multiple external reviews by the Department of Finance. 8 gateway reviews have been undertaken by the Department of Finance. The most recent one finished last week. and the program received a green light from that external review, the Gateway Review. It's also been subject to multiple Digital Transformation Agency assurance reviews throughout the programs.
Environment Minister Murray Watt has committed to learning from this.
This may well be a contract that demonstrates the need for greater oversight and of consultants.
Dr. Minchin said they're taking the feedback about the website on board and changes are being made.
There are no doubts that, as I said in my opening statement, the website itself and the front end has not met all user needs in the community, and there are active programs underway to improve and act on that feedback. So I think it's reasonable for the Australian public to ask us what's going on.
That is Justine Longmore's report, ending there with the CEO of the Bureau of Meteorology in the job for 3 weeks, Stuart Minchin. You're listening to The Country Hour. Plenty of texts coming in, 0467 842 722. Lorraine says, watch out with the phone lines and the SMS going into meltdown. Read the bomb stuff. He's got guts to try and defend while the new site costs so much, and it really won't matter what he says Lorraine. Well, it does in a way. I think the actions obviously speak louder than words. I wonder if there would be less complaints about the cost if it was a better product, but maybe that's just me. You can send a text and let me know if you think that's right or not. Manuel's at Mount Mercer, back on the baler, photo to suit as well. It's dried up in time to be on the baler there at Mount Mercer. You can see the wind turbines in the background there, and round bales being baled by you at the moment. Thanks very much for sending that in. 0467 842 722 if you want to send us a text here on The Country. It wasn't just Senate estimates in federal politics that has been working this week. There's also been estimates happening in New South Wales, where it's been confirmed that no penalties have been imposed following an investigation into environmental water use at Tooral National Park in the far west of New South Wales. But a budget estimates hearing in New South Wales State Parliament this week has also heard some matters will be referred to the Director General of Water Compliance. So what's the difference between a farmer misusing water and a government department? Emily Doak reports.
In August, NRAR issued a stop work order at Tooral National Park after an investigation into the operation of certain water infrastructure and the accounting for water use. In budget estimates in the New South Wales Parliament this week, the New South Wales Water Minister Rose Jackson and NRAR Chief Regulatory Officer Grant Barnes were questioned about the matter by National's MLC Wes Fang.
What penalties were applied?
We've worked with the approval holder, who has the legal obligation to record, report and debit water diverted from the western access into the western wetlands in accordance with the principles of the Act. Mm. We've also found, though, that the way they operated those works were in accordance with the licensed approvals. Mm-hmm. So one can't move into an enforcement and therefore application of sanctions when there is no finding of wrongdoing. What we have, however, is in concluding our investigation, identified matters that might be of interest to the Inspector General of Water Compliance, mm-hmm. and we will be making a referral to the Honourable Troy Grant in the coming weeks.
So, in answer to the question that I asked, what penalties were applied?
No penalties were applied.
Laws were broken.
Thank you.
Mr. Fang went on to press the Minister and the Deputy Secretary of the Department of Climate Change, Energy, Environment and Water, Amanda Jones, about the metering and measurement of environmental water.
It depends on the physical conditions and the topography and just how you can form that measurement. Sometimes, if you've got a pump, a meter works. If you've got an expanse where a regulator might release water onto an open floodplain, then you need a methodology to measure that water because you can't meter it.
So you understand, though, that this is part of the issue of why people have concerns around the water space. The Commonwealth Environmental Water Holder is allowed to do one thing that private water holders aren't.
Well, because, Mr. Fang, if you can't understand the difference between a public...
Minister, don't try and patronise me. I'm asking you, if there are no exemptions in place, why are you allowing one government body to do something that you won't allow private citizens to do?
Because government bodies manage environmental water, which is not water that is intended for profit-making productive use. It is a different thing. There is a difference between environmental water and water taken for private consumptive use. There is. And as Ms. Jones has indicated, our effort is to have maximum metering and measuring. That is what we would like to see. But there is a difference between a giant pump that is pumping water to make profit for private consumptive use and can be easily metered, and water released through a regulator over a wetland expanse that it is almost physically impossible to meter. That is the reason
almost
for the
physically
difference.
Almost physically impossible? So it can be done?
It cannot be metered in the same way as water through a pump can be metered. It is physically impossible to meter those two things in the same way.
Mr. Barnes also told the hearing that NRAR's focusing its attention on water compliance issues on blueberry farms on the mid-north coast.
Worth noting that our efforts in the mid-north coast in relation to blueberries is increasing, and we are taking a stronger enforcement stance where we are encountering long-term persistent non-compliance. So to that point, we've just commenced two prosecutions in relation to blueberry growing, typically where infrastructure has been constructed without approval or where water being retained on site is well in excess of a maximum harvestable right. So for NRAR, it remains a focus for us to address some of this long-standing and systemic non-compliance with the industry.
Greens MLC Kate Fairman questioned Rose Jackson about the Aboriginal water strategy and the process of transferring ownership of water licences.
I have heard feedback that there's confusion about who can and should legitimately apply for water access licences under this scheme in different areas, and importantly, who has primacy. There are concerns that someone could just set up a company, for example, give 51% of shares to an Aboriginal person and be eligible. There's also concerns around the assessment criteria, that there's no assessment or ranking around connection to country or the status of the group applying. I'm no doubt how complicated, understand how complicated it is, but there's concerns that there wasn't consultation wide consultation with a lot of groups around how this transfer would be undertaken. So
yeah, I'm happy to take that on. I think one of the challenges here, Ms. Fairman, is, you know, my view is we have to do something to actually transfer ownership to Aboriginal people. And we're not about to make the transfers. We're in a registration of interest process. As you rightly identified, things like the New South Wales government ranking connection to country of Aboriginal people is highly fraught. And I know that's not what you were suggesting, but those kinds of decisions are complicated. To be honest, there was advice that I received not to do this, that it was too hard, that trying to actually practically implement this policy was going to raise all these questions and all these objections, and it would be easier not to do it, not to wade in to this challenging and contested space. And I made a call that actually this was worthwhile doing. Now, that doesn't mean that as an entirely new process that there won't be some bumps along the road, and some of those concerns that you raised are entirely valid. But I want to assure you, we have a very comprehensive process to work through those.
That is Water Minister in New South Wales, Rose Jackson, speaking at their budget estimates about water policy in that state and how it really connects with us in Victoria, with both states sharing a large part of the Murray-Darling Basin and the management of environmental water, particularly at Taral National Park in far west New South Wales, where misuse was identified, but no charges will have been laid, with the explanation from the minister is that environmental water held by a government department is different in nature to water being used for profit, like in an irrigation business. It's 19 past 12 here on the Country Hour. A little closer to home in our state, Japanese encephalitis virus was detected for the first time in Horsham's mosquitoes. We read that to you when it was first announced from the Department of Health. They are urging Victorians to protect themselves from bites this summer and consider getting vaccination, with more vaccinations being made available to people, particularly in high-risk areas. Deputy Chief Health Officer for Communicable Disease, Christian McGrath, says the virus can have a range of effects.
So Japanese encephalitis is a disease that's caused by the Japanese encephalitis virus, which is carried by mosquitoes. Now, this virus is new to Australia, really, since 2022, or at least throughout areas like Victoria, New South Wales, and Queensland. And the virus can cause people to become anything from no symptoms, to right through to quite a serious illness and death.
What sort of inflammation is it? From my understanding, it's an inflammation of the brain. So it puts it in quite a serious category when we compare it with other like diseases.
Yeah, correct. So Japanese encephalitis can cause lots of different symptoms. So it can be things from almost like a flu-like illness, so fever, headaches, muscle aches and pains, and some vomiting. But at the severe end of the spectrum, it can cause what's called encephalitis, which is inflammation of the brain. And when that occurs, there's a high risk of complications, and that can include things like coma, paralysis, and other seizures and things like that. But unfortunately, in some people, there's no recovery, and it can lead to death. And in other people, it can cause permanent brain damage.
What are the criterion for the eligibility for the vaccine?
So the vaccine's available for free for all Victorians that live in 24 eligible LGAs, or local government areas, And that's all areas really throughout the north of the state where we're concerned about the risk of possible Japanese encephalitis virus occurring. So it's pretty much open to anyone over 2 months of age who lives or routinely works outside in any of those areas. So we're encouraging people who, you know, spend time outdoor doing outdoor activities that put them at risk of mosquito bites to get vaccinated and to protect themselves from mosquitoes using, you know, mosquito repellent covering up and limiting their time outdoors when mosquitoes are most active at dusk and dawn.
So would you say it's a case of prevention being half the cure? If you're in doubt, seek the vaccine?
Correct. If in doubt, get the vaccine. We know most people spend a lot of time outdoors, especially in, you know, the Victorian summer. So we would recommend getting the vaccine because of those broad eligibility criteria. You should be able to get it from your primary care provider, and there's a few local council areas that are also providing it. It's a good idea to give your GP a call beforehand if you are looking to get the vaccine, just so they can make sure they've got it in stock. But it's free of charge, and it's and people who don't have Medicare are also eligible for the vaccine.
On that note, people who don't have Medicare, does that include backpackers and, let's say, palm workers, people who might be performing quite long hours outside part of their role or their job, but aren't necessarily Victorians?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you live or work in that area, you're in one of the eligible local government areas, you're eligible for free JE vaccine.
That's Deputy Chief Health Officer for Communicable Disease, Christian McGrath, speaking there with our reporter, Tim King. You're listening to The Country Hour, and some breaking news happening today under the announcement today that there will be a cut to about 500 public service jobs in Victoria. There seems to be some major changes on the way. There will be the abolishment of the Victorian Environmental Assessment Council, and it looks like they're merging between the Victorian Fisheries and Game Management Authorities. Now, Fisheries has had major cuts to staff in the last 12 months or so, and a really big restructure to that organisation already, which many of you have wanted to talk with us about on the Country Hour in recent months. It looks like that is going to continue with a merger into the Game Management Authority. What does that mean? What do we know? Mitch Vandevert Holman from CPSU, the Community and Public Sector Union in Victoria, can join you on the Country Hour now. Welcome back.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
What does this mean? Do we know much about the Fisheries and Game Management merger? Does that mean even more job losses for fisheries?
Now, we had a conversation yesterday with the Treasurer's office, and we were told this is just a merger of two organisations. There are no job losses in the line agencies slated to come out of this. There will, of course, only be one CEO of the new organisation. So there are cuts to executives, but there are no cuts to the line officers. That is what we have been told.
Just a merger, but why do it if it's not going to save money?
That's a question for the government.
What do your members tell you about what it could mean to frontline services, or are you still trying to work that out?
So Silver Review was only formally announced at 9 a.m. this morning. Our members are absolutely abuzz with this news because we're committed public servants. We're interested to know what the government wants to do in terms of service delivery. So I can't speak to that right now.
There's also an understanding the Victorian Environmental Assessment Council will be abolished. Now, this council led to the creation of things like the Barmer National Park in northern Victoria, and national parks along many of our waterways and in various areas of the state as well. Are there concerns there?
But the government's position is that the function that that body performed will be done by another part of government. So it's not the function that is going, it is the organisation. And like I said, we understand that that is no loss of jobs.
And have you heard much about Agriculture Victoria? Obviously, that organisation has been through a number of rounds of job losses in recent years. Is it slated for more under the Silver Review?
As far as we can tell, not in the line staff. Now, the final report of the Silver Review showed something that we had long suspected, that the 60 major changes that have been implemented since the start of this financial year, one of which was the massive one in Agricultural Victoria, was Silver Review by stealth. That's 619 of 1,055 to go. Of the remainder, we understand that there are no additional cuts in the line departments, and that includes Agriculture Victoria.
And obviously, we're heavily focused on the Country Hour on agriculture and the environment and how these things interact in regional areas. You're the union that represents community and public sector workers, though, and this review goes right across the government. What else are you worried about from the Silver Review and what it could mean to your members?
So there's a couple of things in there. First, the review talks about rebalancing. That's the word it uses. Rebalancing of senior policy officer roles. We're concerned about the volume of roles that are going to be rebalanced out because we believe that's code for being made redundant. They say it won't decrease the total number of FTE because they'll replace them with lower grade roles and they'll reclassify those higher levels. So we're concerned about the impact that'll have on our members. The review talks about embedding the working from office requirement as a performance goal, which we have some serious concerns about because not all our members, we don't think that our members should, their performance should be judged by their ability to attend the office. The review also talks about cutting some senior technical specialist roles. So these are our scientists, our technicians, particularly out in the regional areas of Victoria where they're doing that important work. We're concerned about which roles are to go. Government says they're trying to cut where that position has been used for executive positions and not for scientists and technicians, but we're going to be watching very, very closely.
And I was about to say, this is not the first time the government has tried to make cuts to the public service to varying degrees of success over their time in government. They've been in government for all but 4 years of this century. They often say it's not frontline, it's executive where they look to cut. Is that what you believe will happen here?
So the cuts that have already gone through, that's 619, as far as we understand, there were no executive cuts in. That was all line agency staff. Of the remainder, about 300 are expected in the executive level, and we welcome that. It is the union's view that there is real bloating in the executive levels. The number of them has increased by 200% since 2014, and the number of staff each of them are managing has halved from about 56 to 25. Now, In terms of future cuts, whether or not they're going to come in executives or line staff. I'm so sorry, Warwick. I've forgotten your question.
It's okay. We might leave it there anyway. Mitch van der Veert-Holman, we really appreciate your time on the program today. Thanks very much for joining us. That's the CPSU Victorian Branch Assistant Secretary. The line was just holding in for us there, which is always good. The government announces in line with this review about 330 senior executive and technical specialist roles will be cut, saving $359 million over the next 4 years, while reducing spending on consultants is estimated to save $113 million. We understand, and as you've just heard, the union understands Victorian Fisheries and Game Management Authorities will be rolled into one. You can tell us how you feel about that. And the Victorian Environment Assessment Council, VEAC, which created things like the Barmer National Park, among others, is to be axed, given A lot of its work, the government says, is duplicated by the eminent panel for community engagement. You can let us know what you think about that. 0467 842 722. Jeremy Morton's on the line on 1300 977 222. Just quickly before rural news, Jeremy, you were calling about what the minister was saying in regards to the misuse or of monitoring of the use of environmental water in Tyrrell National Park, saying no charges could be laid because it was an environmental department, and that's inherently different to the management of water from irrigators for profit. What do you want to say?
Oh, well, it sort of shocks me that the minister doesn't understand that that's not actually the way it is. You know, water is just water under the National Water Initiative, and the same principles apply regardless. And at the end of the day, even the water that private irrigators use, that's public water that's then allocated under licence to irrigators. So it's all public water. I'm astounded that that's what she actually thinks or believes, or that's her response in that, you know, New South Wales Upper House inquiry. Plus, they purchased Tyrrell in 2008. They've had plenty of time to work out how to measure that water.
And look, you're a former National Irrigators Council chair. You're an irrigator in New South Wales. Is there any way for irrigators to test the government on that, or do you have to take the government's word for it?
It's up to ENRA, effectively. They're the ones that are the regulator in this case. And, I did read that they didn't proceed with prosecuting a government department because that wouldn't be a good look, was one of the responses. It's like, well, it really doesn't matter. I mean, if you're not compliant, you're not compliant. It doesn't matter who's owning or managing or controlling the water. I think it's an absolute disgrace. And it's a bit of an own goal because they've gone through, really heavily come down on irrigators to make sure that they're compliant, and gone with this no meter, no pump rule. And now, obviously, you do actually need some way of measuring water, but not all water can be metered through a pipe. So it's a bit of an own goal from New South Wales, and I'm stunned that the minister actually thinks there's a difference between water that's going to out under the environment or for productive use. It's all just water at the end of the day, doing different things.
Jeremy, thanks very much for your call. Jeremy Morton there, an irrigator in New South Wales, responding to one of our stories. You can call 1300 977 222. Right now, though, let's get rural news with Emma Field today. Good afternoon, Emma.
G'day, Warwick. Let's start in Western Australia, where the WA government has announced some significant fishing restrictions that will impact both commercial and recreational fishers. This is for demersal fish, so species such as pink snapper, jewfish, red emperor and Bolton groper. Fisheries Minister Jackie Jarvis says there will be a complete ban on catching any demersal fish in the West Coast Zone from Kalbarri to Augusta, which is a coastline of almost 1,000 kilometres.
Essentially, you know, we were on the brink of perhaps sending things like jewfish to extinction, so we actually really need to make sure that we have two full spawning periods where we're closed. We will then work with the recreational sector and industry to actually have some other more permanent closures, 10-year closures of other regions where we know there are breeding grounds. But the aim was always to try and get fishers back on the water as soon as possible.
Phil DeGraw is a Kalbarri-based commercial fisherman. He fishes in the West Coast and Gascoyne demersal fisheries regions, and he says he is gutted by the announcement from the WA government.
It sounds like it's a buyout of the licence, and that's the end of my fishery. I've got enough entitlement in the Gascoyne for 2 months' work, but I need another nine months back down here to make the size of my boat, my operation, to keep it viable. You just can't afford to keep boats just sitting in the pen there for, I've got about 2 months' work up in the Gascoyne. So it's just not feasible.
The Australian Pesticide and Vet Medicine Authority says delays to approvals for ag chemicals and medicines will probably be slow for another 6 months. CEO Scott Hansen appeared before the Senate Rural and Regional Affairs and Transport Committee this week. He was asked by Queensland Nationals Senator Matt Canavan why processing times for major applications for assessments have blown out. Senator Canavan asked why chemical lobby group CropLife claims the time frame for assessments has gone from meeting processing times 98% of the time a few years ago to just 54% of the time now.
We've got an incredibly talented and hardworking workforce that we've rearranged how they go about their jobs over the last 12 months. They're resettling into those new workflows and those new work patterns. But probably the biggest challenge for us is in this predictability about timeframes, is our legislation actually requires us to be satisfied that an application meets the statutory criteria of it being safe. And not partially satisfied, not at first glance satisfied, but actually satisfied. We're getting more and more complex applications coming in as the chemistries and the types of products that are being presented are more and more targeted. They're very different to the broad spectrum applications we would have seen a couple of years ago.
I hope you do understand that this has a real cost on the farm sector, these delays. Just a commitment from you that you're doing all you can to reduce those costs.
Yeah, definitely. We understand that there's missed opportunities and there's impact. We're very conscious of the government's agenda on productivity and we're doing everything we can to speed ourselves up without trading off that important piece, which is the safety of the products and the efficacy.
And lastly, Warwick, would you pay $250,000 for a box of cherries? For the past 44 years, the Sydney markets have auctioned a box of the best cherries to help raise money for charity. This year was the biggest fundraiser yet, with more than $250,000 going towards helping seriously ill children from rural areas get to medical appointments and back home for Christmas. As Annie Brown reports, the highest priced box this year came from Wangaratta.
This is the Sydney Markets Foundation Cherry Ball. Two businesses, Parisi and Trim's Fresh Marylands, have matched each other's bid of $80,000.
We've got table 31 at $80,000. We have table number 35 at $80,000. It's $160,000. So!
This, combined with another $100,000 from Sydney Market Credit Service and 40 Sydney Market businesses, gives a grand total of $260,000. But it's all for a good cause. The money goes to charity Little Wings. The box of cherries up for auction is deemed the best at the markets and was chosen by a blind judging panel. For the second year in a row, Smith's Fruit, based in Wangaratta, took out the top prize.
And Warwick, that is a cherry high price. And that wraps up Rural News.
And I'm even though I love cherries in the field, I'm not paying more than $250,000 for a box of cherries. I think I'm happy to move on to some cheaper ones. Emma Field, though, you would have heard her yesterday when things were going bad with our reception out at Rapanyup. Does a great job, particularly back in the studio, whilst I am out and about for all the broadcasts we do in the country through the year. So a big shout out to her for a lot of her work, particularly on the 80th as well. Let's go to the Bureau of Meteorology before we go to your text. Michael Efron's there. Hi, Michael.
G'day, Warwick.
How are we looking around Victoria today? It's getting hot.
It is, and also windy as well. And that combination is pushing up the fire danger through a lot of the state. So we do have a fire weather warning out for the Mallee, Wimmera and Northern Country today with those fresh to hot and gusty northwesterly winds. It's really windy, especially in the south and southwest around Colac towards Mortlake as well, seeing gusts there around 60, 70, even 80 kilometres an hour, and temperatures already in the low 30s. Through this afternoon, we are looking at tops in the high 30s through the Mallee, 38 for Mildura, 37 at Swan Hill, 36 at Horsham, elsewhere at Echuca 36, Bendigo 35, Wangaratta 35, Sale 31, Bairnsdale 32. We are seeing a cooler southwesterly change pushing into the very far southwest just at the moment. So looking at some of those temperatures, Portland 23 and Port Fairy currently 25. So we are seeing that change just getting into the far southwest. It will move northeastwards through the rest of this afternoon into the evening as well. There is a slight chance of a thunderstorm in the south and southwest behind that change, and overnight tonight as well into Friday. So not much rainfall associated with that activity, but something to watch through the rest of today. As we head into Friday, we do see that change continuing to move north and east, but not as strong once it gets into northern Victoria. So still looking at elevated fire danger, especially for the Mallee. Keep a watch out on that. We may see another fire weather warning for the Mallee. And those temperatures still mid to high 30s, 38 at Albury-Wodonga, 37 at Wangaratta, 38 for Mildura and Swan Hill, 37 at Echuca. Seymour 34, and then into the south, a lot cooler, 21 for Bairnsdale, 23 at Sale. Melbourne 25, Hamilton 27, Warrnambool 20, Ballarat 29. So really big difference there in temperatures on Friday. We will see moderate to fresh westerly winds. There will be some isolated showers and storms, most likely during the afternoon and evening over central and eastern parts, mainly about the ranges. Chance of a rumble in the southwest very early on Friday, prior to dawn, I would think. Then as we head into the weekend, on Saturday we're going to see a front and trough crossing the state. A bit more moisture around as well, so showers extending across most areas, but especially Gippsland and over those northeast ranges where we will see some thunderstorms developing into the afternoon and evening. So there we could see 1 to 10 millimetres. Elsewhere, generally light falls expected. Moderate westerly winds, it will be a lot cooler in the north compared to Friday, so tops over those northern parts around 27 to 31, and then in the south looking at 20 to 25. Sunday looks really settled with the next ridge building over the state, so mostly sunny conditions in the north, partly cloudy in the south, where temperatures will be around 18 to 21, in the north 22 to 26. And then Monday, Tuesday and Wednesday looking quite settled again, with isolated showers continuing about the exposed coast, but temperatures generally low to mid-20s in the south, mid to high 20s across northern districts. But today, very hot and windy, and then for Friday, still looking hot for the north, and also looking at that elevated fire danger as well.
So how high are the winds getting up in speeds there, Michael, today?
Yeah, so today we are seeing gusts getting close to 80 kilometres an hour through parts of the southwest. But Mount Gellibrand, which is near Colac, really exposed location, we've seen a gust there of 102 kilometres an hour at 20 past 11 this morning. But Mortlake was up to 80 kilometres an hour. And in the Grampians, Mount William, 70, Cape Otway, 76. So really focused over that southwest district at the moment.
And how long will the winds hang around for before they start to peter out?
It's a few hours. Late afternoon into the evening, we'll see a period of gusty winds from the south-southwest, but then through the rest of the evening, they should tend to drop away. So quite a significant drop in temperature in the south, could see drop of 10 to 15 degrees.
Oh, so yeah, so that's significant. Sorry, the phone line's just breaking up, and I should ask you about warnings before I let you go. Any warnings to keep an eye on?
Yeah, so just the fire weather warning out today for the Mallee, Wimmera and Northern Country, and then potentially for parts of the north tomorrow as well.
Brilliant. Thanks very much for that, Michael, and apologies for that. The line sort of just got a little bit funny at the end, but we got the major bits of information, and we always appreciate your time. On the text line, there's a couple of texts I need to read for you. A lot about the Bureau. I think you know how a lot of that goes, so I might skip that just for the minute. Chris says on the text line, though, going, Warwick, you spoke a while back about American butter. We did. The American butter that's for sale at Woolworths, that's in the green and gold labelling, really took the ire of the dairy industry for the fact that it's in green and gold and the fact that it's this white butter that's very different and they're worried about how consumers will take it. It was a major story for us. Well, Chris goes on to say, yesterday I bought some peanut butter. It was branded Skippy peanut butter and it's made in America. No, Chris, really? Skippy peanut butter for sale in Australia, made in America? God, have a look at this. If anyone's got a jar at home, snap a photo. Send it in 0467 842 722. Also on the text line, I like this one. This one is actually labelled anonymous. Anonymous for this one, Wazza. Started yesterday harvesting and got 10 metres into the paddock. and the header died. Spent the last hour fishing for the rag I misplaced at some point last season. And guess what? I'm all back up and running in time to catch the last half hour of the country hour. Happy and safe harvesting, everyone. I love that you wanted that to be anonymous, and I will respect that. But 10 metres into the paddock for your first breakdown, that's got to be some kind of record. Thank you very much for sending that through. And the other text is the solving of a mystery. I don't know if you can hear that banging. That is the most incredible thing that was sent in the mail to me. It came in a packaging with not much of a label on it, just saying that it was posted to me, Warwick Long at the Country Hour, here in our office in Shepparton, and it was all taped up. Now, we'd just had security training at the ABC. One of the things that you have to click on and go through a whole online video telling you to be worried about the mail that could be sent to you at the organisation and what to do if that mail looks a little bit dodgy, taped up without much information on it, and how to dispose of it correctly. Look, my friends, I broke all of those rules. I thought if it's being sent to me, it might be a relic. I don't know what it's like. I popped the top off it. I saw bunched up bit of newspaper. A dead bug fell out. I was a little bit worried, but when I opened it up, the most glorious thing came up, and that banging that you heard is the most incredible old source bottle that says the property of the Goulburn Valley Source Works, Shepparton, Victoria. It's like one of the old bottles I was checking out yesterday at Woods Farming and Heritage Museum. And it was sent to me in the mail and I didn't know where it came from. I did a few social media posts to try and find, didn't hear anything. Well, it's come from Shovel. Because Shovel sent a text to say, hey, Warwick, did you get the SourceWorks bottle? Yes, Shovel, I did. I must admit, for a little while, I thought it could be a breach of ABC security to open the mail, but I'm so glad I did. This bottle is incredible. Thank you very much for sending it through to me. It is greatly appreciated, and I love that you've had to send that text to tell me it was you. Hey, we're going to go to the High Country in a few seconds to find out how the season's going there, but first...
On ABC Radio Victoria, you're with Warwick Long for the Victorian Country Hour.
We've been looking at these job cuts announced today from the Victorian government in light of the Silver Review. It also shows that there will be a merging between the Victorian Fisheries and Game Management Authorities. We also know the Victorian Environmental Assessment Council will be abolished. We've heard minimal cuts to Agriculture Victoria. A lot of that work has already been done. Getting reaction to that and what it means. We've heard from the union. Let's hear from Jeff Borman, who is an Upper House member with the Shooters, Fishers and Farmers Party, who's on the line now. Welcome back to the Country Hour.
Thanks, Warwick. Thanks for having me on.
First of all, the Victorian Fisheries and Game Management Authorities being combined after all of those cuts to Victorian fisheries we've been reporting on. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I haven't had a chance to have a proper full briefing from the Minister, but my understanding as it is there'll be no job cuts now, because there was obviously some beforehand, and that I'm looking at it just with a fairly outside view. I don't see anything to worry about at the moment, but as I've always said in this job, the devil is in the details, and once I've got the details, I'll be a little happier.
What details will you be looking for?
Oh, exactly what they're going to do and how they're going to restructure it. I would like to hope there is basically the promise or comment I got was there would be no job losses, and frankly, as long as there's no job losses or any more job losses, then I think from a hunter's perspective, it'll be good, because the GMA and VFA will become, I've forgotten the name of the entity itself at the moment, but it will become something. And I think my understanding is that hunting will be able to be promoted or advocated for, much like the fisheries do at the moment, that the GMA were precluded from previously.
And yeah, and fishing, recreational fishing, seems to have a lot of power within the ears of government. A lot of policy goes towards that. I think you would agree that the hunting community don't feel like they have the same ear of government. So combining the two, you can see some positives there.
Well, absolutely. And that's part of my job, is to be in the ear of the government for the hunters. But we needed a hunting regulator and we needed a fishing regulator. And to be frank, fishing is a form of hunting, except you use a fishing line and all that. It makes at least logical sense to do this. But We'll wait and see how it works out, but I am cautiously optimistic.
And the abolition of the Victorian Environmental Assessment Council, this is the body that did major studies and recommended the formations of lots of national parks around the state in the past. Controversially, the Barmer National Park and the Greater Goulburn National Parks that go along some of the river systems there in the River Edgum National Parks, I should say, in northern Victoria. Your party and a lot of your supporters have been strongly critical of government attempts to form more national parks. So do you see that as a positive?
The answer is yes and no. I think VIAC was always set up to rubber stamp a policy for the government. And if that was their job, then I can't really criticise them for that. I can criticise them for the policy. But my understanding is that their function itself will not be gone, just VIAC, that one of the departments will assume that function. And again, the devil is in the details. Just because VIAC's gone doesn't mean there will be no one advocating for the environment, as it's put to me. Not that I see it that way.
500 public service job cuts. Is it important for government to be looking at this, or do you have concerns about services for regional Victorians?
I always have concerns about services for regional Victorians. One of the problems we have in our society of Australia, let alone Victoria, is the urbanisation of our society, and those that are in the regional areas are getting less and less of the pie. And I think it's lost on a lot of people that a job loss in a regional area is a far bigger problem than a job loss in the city. In city, it's easier to find a job. Obviously, with a lot of people looking at the same time, it's not easy, but it's easier. But when you're out in the regions, there's a very limited pool. So I'm hoping that the job losses will be kept to a minimum. I understand the Silver Review is, I haven't had a chance to read it, but I've been listening to questions at question time. There will be, unfortunately, people affected by it. I don't know the whens and hows or whos, but I just hope that when the time comes, people remember, or the government remembers, there are people at the end of this line, people that will be a bit worried coming up to Christmas.
Jeff Borman, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, Warren.
And thanks for stepping out of Parliament to have a chat to us. That's Jeff Borman there, who's from the Shooters, Fishers and Farmers Party. Let's go to Gippsland's High Country now, which has benefited from recent rain. But this year, like for many of you, has been a real challenge for producers. Emma Field spoke with Swifts Creek producer Kate Commons and James Turner, who runs a farm at Reedy Flat, and started by asking James about this year's conditions.
Been quite mixed, really. There's a real difference across geographic regions up here. Further south at Reedy Flat, where I live, we had a fantastic summer and start to autumn, whereas further north, Bindi, Omeo, Benambra, were quite the opposite, missing out on a lot of rain. And then through winter, it dried off and we failed to get a start to spring. We probably lost best part of 2 months of our growing season in early spring.
And so what does that mean for your business, not having those early spring months?
Yeah, it's hard to plan because that's our best growing season is that September, October, and it's what you sort of bank on most reliable rainfall. So for us it was just basically an extension of winter and looking at alternatives in terms of turning off stock earlier and destocking if we had to. Fortunately, by the end of October, the season turned around and we started to receive some rain. So, yeah, the season has drastically improved.
And what does that mean now? Are you going to look at maybe you've had the moisture, maybe some cropping or something? How are you going to manage the moisture you've got?
Yeah, that's a bit of a difficult one too because we're coming into the summer, warmer months. Obviously, the option for summer cropping, but we're certainly not out of the woods in terms of a dry, hot summer. So we won't be looking to make massive changes, and unfortunately we've probably destocked a bit early on some classes of stock, but we can always sit on feed for the autumn, which is less reliable up here than a spring. So long grass in the paddock is better than no grass.
And Kate, what about you? Where do you farm and what kind of operation do you have?
Well, we're producing feeder steers. We're 100% Angus. And our country, we tend to have our steers at Swifts Creek, and most of the female part of the business there at Hinnamungee and also at the other side of Benambra. That's where we run our cows on a higher country. And that country out there has been okay, and we've just recently had a pretty good dollop of rain last week and a little bit more this last weekend. But we would very much like to see some more rain, because we have sold quite a lot of our cattle early. We sold them in June, early June, just to make sure that we had enough to carry everything else through, and then because we just didn't get the rain in spring, late winter that we thought we might get, we had to dig in again and sell more, just to make sure things weren't going too hungry.
So it was the Hinnamungee block mainly that suffered.
Yeah, we virtually destocked there because it was just so bare. Mm. And the ones that we did have, we fed pellets. We were feeding pellets every day just to make sure that they were able to go through the winter and then had a condition to then calve them down and look after their calves.
And so after having to destock, how much time will it take to build those stock levels up again? Do you plan for that, or?
When I say destock, we're not destocking totally. We've kept our cow numbers largely intact, but we sold our steers. So that's part of our drought strategy, really, is to sell steers early because we can, and it just means that you don't have that fatter, you know, that better feeder steer. You know, because normally we'd be selling them around 400 kilos, we'll lower half of that. But at least they had gone down the road and were able to look after our females.
And you do have a unique environment up here because it is alpine in a lot of the areas, isn't it? So it gets very cold in winter. You can't rely on that necessarily, the green feed, can you?
Absolutely not. But you can rely on it being cold, and I think you can rely on it being very windy.
Mm. Which has been this year, hasn't it?
It's been an awful year for wind, and you get a little bit of rain, and then, you know, a couple of days later it's hot, it's dry, there's dust blowing around the paddocks, and you're thinking, well, that's the end of that bit of moisture.
Now, you're a former teacher. Did you ever teach James, or...?
Yes, I did.
Was he a good student? Or?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
He went on to do ag science, so isn't that right?
He did. Yeah. I taught his sister, I think, as well, and quite a lot of other people in the local area.
How does it feel now? We've got both of them here, actually. One's on the farm and the other one's a vet. It must feel good to be the teacher of these two young people that are contributing now into ag and into the community.
It's wonderful. I think that's one of the joys of being a teacher in a small country school, is when your past pupils come back and they come back into the community, and it just enriches your community, having people having gone away, done their education, experienced other parts of life, done interesting things, and then that comes back and it enriches all of us.
Oh, I love that. That's Kate Commons there from Swifts Creek, also Benambra, speaking with Emma Field. You also heard from James Turner there at Reedy Flat. Let's go to markets. Market time. Let's go to Wagga Wagga for the sheep market report. Leanne Dax is there.
Good afternoon. It was very much a stall market at Wagga, in a yarding of 39,800 lambs and 22,000 sheep. Quality dropped away noticeably, with very little weight offered, and the bulk of the yarding was under 22 kilos carcass weight. Not all processors turned up to the sale, and not all exporters operated fully. There was plenty of store orders in place, and competition from the store buyers was very solid, with prices firm to $2 and $4 stronger. Trade lambs 20 to 24 kilo sold firm $195 to $274, 24 to 26 $270 to $310, 26 to 30 kilo $280 to $330, selling $10 cheaper to average $1,074 a kilogram carcass weight. Over 30 kilos topped at $342. Store lambs back to the paddock with a bit of weight and frame $152 to $198, lambs to feed on $195 to $248, with the sheep yet to be sold. I'm Leanne Duggs for MLA.
I love this text from Doug. G'day, Warwick. The wheel keeps turning. I was a fisheries and wildlife officer between 72 and 95. Both fish and game were always part of fisheries and wildlife. I've seen many incarnations over the years, and here we go again. back to the original. Fish and wildlife forever. Love that, Doug. Thank you very much for that text. Thank you, too, for sending through Dave at Lake Tyres, the Skippy imported peanut butter. I think we need to learn more about that as well. But that's it for us today. We'll be back with you for the Country Hour tomorrow. It's 1 o'clock right now.